Researchers at the University of Wisconsin crunched data, and they've concluded that nothing rivals Hurricane Harvey in the U.S. in the historical record in magnitude. And Houston is a city that's had 16 hurricanes in its first century. But one of the draws of Houston is its affordable housing. And in a regulation-skittish region, there are questions about how those houses have been built and where. Parts of the city that used to be prairie that could mitigate flooding have been paved over. And our next guest says he saw this coming. Historian John Barry wrote Rising Tide, The Great Mississippi Flood of 1927. He's also a New Orleans resident and a former member of a flood control board there. We'll link you to his writing about Katrina. But John, start with your thoughts as you watch Harvey.
Well, it's not fun. Every time an event like this happens, people in Washington talk about having a new policy. Usually nothing happens.
Start with how we address these storms. We call them 100-year storms, 500-year storms. Remind us, because we're hearing people even this week say, wow, that means it only happens once every 500 years. What does it mean?
A 100-year storm is a storm with a 1% chance of likelihood of hitting any single year. So as each year passes, the likelihood of seeing a 100-year event increases. In the average person's lifetime, it is very likely that they will see at least one storm in their area greater than a so-called 100-year storm. And in fact, in Houston, there have been three 500-year events in the last 3 years. It is one of the most Orwellian, dangerous policy phrases in the English language.
Well, that's what you wrote after Katrina. You say there are three problems in how the country addresses these kinds of disasters: the standard itself, geology and sea level rise, and politics. Are you saying jettison that standard? What would that do if we weren't talking about 100-year and 500-year floods?
It's not so much jettison the standard as understand its meaning. Maybe if they change the terminology, people might realize the risk involved. You know, if they knew protection to the 100-year level actually means they have almost a two-thirds chance over a period of a lifetime of seeing at least one storm that's going to devastate them, then they might rethink where they move. You know, that standard was really pushed largely by real estate developers. The Corps of Engineers actually wanted a much higher standard. The rest of the developed world protects densely populated areas to a much higher standard, at least 500-year, and usually 1,000, and in some cases a 10,000-year standard, whereas we're using a 100-year standard. The phrase itself is so misleading, I would just as soon dump the phrase.
Right. And talk about protecting against the seriousness of storms. And so, for instance, the Dutch protect their cities against a 10,000-year storm.
Correct.
So that comes to the second suggestion you're making, which is geology, sea level rise. This idea that we're losing landmass in areas. We don't have permeable land. There's no place for water to go. We know that global warming and the sea level rise and the sea temperature rise is feeding hurricanes and making them much more powerful. When you have warmer water, it's pulled up into these hurricanes. So what would you do there?
Well, first, let me go back for a second to the 100-year standard. Because of that, you get people settling in areas that really should not be lived in. I think developers, you know, fall into the same mindset as somebody who might buy the property. They think, yeah, that's okay. That's FEMA standard. It seems reasonable. But the standard itself was set for insurance purposes only. It was never intended as a safety standard. People do not understand it, and it's become dangerous.
And so, John Barry, would you be one who would be for something we've been hearing about, which is instead of pumping money into rebuilding homes that are being destroyed on the coast, you know, FEMA buying them back at the value of the house and then raising them so that we get back more land?
I absolutely think that buyouts are underutilized. Another issue, which you mentioned a minute ago, permeability. You don't have to put cement that causes runoff down on your sidewalks and streets. There are products you can use that allow water to seep through.
So permeability, you know, maybe buy back homes, create more wetlands, places for, you know, storms to come onto shore.
Some of the policies on creating wetlands don't make any sense either. If you develop in an area that's a wetland, then you have to mitigate that by creating or preserving wetland somewhere else. what often happens is instead of building land on the coast of Louisiana, and that would be very useful, instead they'll go 50 miles inland and flood something and create a wetland there, which satisfies requirement for mitigation, but doesn't do any good whatsoever to preserve coastal Louisiana. The whole flood insurance program needs serious looking at, and it expires September 30th. I think it'll just be, I hate the phrase kicking the can down the road. I think that's the most overused phrase, but I'm going to use it here. I don't think they're going to really seriously address the problem in the next few weeks. I think they'll simply reauthorize it, try to address it in the future.
Well, that brings us to the third point that you make, which is politics. You know, politicians and lawmakers have to have the backbone to do some of the things needed, including the debate in the flood insurance program is, should taxpayers continue to dole out money to people whose homes are on the coast and are constantly destroyed, or should they not? Environmentalists say, you know, there's no incentive for people to move in from the coast if they keep rebuilding. Is that some of the politics you're talking about?
In Louisiana, they tried to reform the flood insurance program a few years ago, and there were people whose homes were worth $80,000 to $100,000 in coastal Louisiana whose rates suddenly and who had never flooded, whose rates suddenly jumped to thousands of dollars a year. Obviously, that would make this area utterly uninhabitable simply because of the flood insurance rates. It is not a simple question. Take New Orleans, for example. New Orleans has been called the inevitable city on the impossible site. The impossible site is obvious. There is risk there. But the inevitable part of it is also obvious because that's a port that services the entire Mississippi Valley, which extends not just straight north to Minneapolis and St. Paul, but to Pittsburgh, to Kansas City, to Omaha, Tulsa. All those areas actually have direct access to the ocean through the Mississippi River in New Orleans. So it's a very serious question and a complex question.
We'll talk about New Orleans for just a second so we can compare. Because as you wrote again, this is in 2015, 10 years after Katrina, that amazingly to those familiar with the city, it wasn't only thriving, it was attracting talent. New Orleans was at the top nationwide in Forbes in growth and college grads. It was a destination for working-age Americans. It had Entrepreneur Week. It just was thriving because people flocked there. Volunteers who flocked there stayed there. You had questions about whether or not lawmakers and politicians there were going to follow through and do things like funnel more sediment down to build up landmass. But do you see the same possibility for Houston?
I don't. I think there are a lot of differences between the situations. New Orleans has sort of a mythic place in America, and it's kind of a romantic image, I think. Plus, the city itself was threatened with outright destruction. New Orleans is a very poor city. The state's a poor state. That's none of those things apply to Houston. Its economy is vastly stronger than New Orleans. It's a much bigger city, has many more resources. Texas has more resources than Louisiana. I'm sure there'll be thousands, if not tens of thousands, of volunteers who go down to help individuals rebuild, but it's not the same kind of situation.
Well, what is the number one thing as you watch Houston, the one thing when you say it's what happens afterwards that counts? What's the one thing that you would say would need to happen in Houston from your historical viewpoint?
Well, chiefly really some serious rethinking about zoning and water management. There is this Dutch phrase, which New Orleans has adopted and talked a lot about, but hasn't actually done much about it, and it's called living with water. I think maybe other than New Orleans, Houston may be the single major city in the country that needs to take that most seriously.
Well, because as you've told us, they should heed the words of T.S. Eliot, that the power of water is often forgotten by the dwellers in cities, ever, however, implacable, keeping his seasons and rages destroyer reminder of what men choose to forget. Waiting, watching, waiting. That's the water. John Barry, author of The Rising Tide and an historian who's looked closely at these water events in history. John, thank you so much as always.
Okay, thank you.